This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, Rescue Mission. The federal government working with Qantas to organise flights to pick up stranded Aussie tourists in South America. And stay away. Rural communities across Australia plead with state governments to stop city dwellers from making a coronavirus escape.
We're going to have to act more strongly. What these communities are starting to feel is the anxiety of COVID-19 and caravans becoming the cruise ships of the outback.
In the United States, the country's coronavirus death toll has now moved past China, where the virus originated, with 3,500 deaths. However, the rate of infections in the US appears to be slowing, and while the experts say that shows social distancing rules are working, they insist now is not the time to ease those restrictions. North America correspondent Catherine Diss reports from Washington.
These are the masks we're donating to the hospital. I'm hoping to take 100 up to Sibley tomorrow. Very simple, easy to do. I have not sewn in more than 40 years.
Ginny Phillips is sewing much-needed face masks for her local hospital.
I was so motivated that I ordered a sewing machine online and got to YouTube videos and taught myself how to sew and then taught myself how to sew masks.
It's just one way to stop the spread of COVID-19. But for most of the community, strict social distancing rules are all we have. Jen Cates is an infectious diseases expert.
This is really the best medicine we have right now to curtail this while we wait for better testing, while we wait to make sure that the hospitals have what they need. This is our medicine. There's evidence from other countries where this has worked.
And there's evidence it's starting to work here too.
So, for example, there's some evidence in California, in the Bay Area, that the number of new cases is reducing. There's certainly early evidence in the Boston area. These are good signs that if you do put these strict measures in place, a couple weeks later, you can start to see an impact.
Are we seeing any reduction in the rate of infection in those hotspots like New York, for instance, which, of course, is of huge concern?
Yeah, I'm not sure yet we can confidently say that. You need to have these measures in place at least 2 weeks before you can start to detect patterns. And then it's not just a daily pattern. I mean, we really need to see a sustained decrease. We're not there yet.
The doubling of infections in America's epicenter, New York, has slowed from every second day to every sixth. But who it hits and who it doesn't is still taking people by surprise.
This virus is the great equalizer. My brother Chris is positive for coronavirus, found out this morning.
Andrew Cuomo is the governor of New York. His brother is well-known CNN host Chris Cuomo.
He social distancing, yes, but people wind up exposing you and then they find out they're positive a couple of days later.
New York may now be in effective lockdown, but it hasn't made the progress California has. Experts say that's because the West Coast state implemented strict movement measures when the virus was first detected, which slowed down the spread considerably. New York was slower to act. This is Catherine Diss in Washington, reporting for AM.
The federal government is negotiating with Qantas about organising special flights to South America to rescue stranded Australians. Some countries shut their borders and imposed curfews with little to no warning, making it extremely difficult for some expats to scramble to larger cities to plot their return. There are also 10 cruise ships with more than 600 Australians on board who are desperate to return home. The Foreign Minister is Maurice Payne. I spoke with her earlier. Minister, good morning. Let's look at the cases that you're dealing with. There is a planned flight from Uruguay tomorrow taking passengers from the Ocean Atlantic, but passengers on another boat, the Greg Mortimer, are being told they'll have to wait 14 days until after the last person's experienced fever. They could be stuck there for some time.
The Greg Mortimer has had a number of issues on board. We've had a gentleman in his late 60s taken to shore in Montevideo yesterday, I think, to go into isolation. And it is very difficult for those who have had flu-like symptoms, given concerns internationally, not just in South America, obviously, but internationally, about the impact of coronavirus. We've been working closely with authorities to ensure that we are able to support support those passengers when they are allowed to leave the ship. But like in Australia, there are different quarantine restrictions being imposed around the world and different requirements for isolation. I understand our ambassador in Buenos Aires is in contact with the passengers and supporting them through that information. But there's no denying that this is a very difficult situation. And of course, Australians overseas have to comply with the international laws that are imposed on the countries in which they find themselves. That doesn't make it any easier.
A charter flight has arrived from Peru, but the government, I understand, is planning another. There are hundreds of Australians spread out across that country, unable to move easily because of a curfew. How will you retrieve all of those people and get them home in an affordable way?
We will support as many Australians as we can to come home. As I've said to you and to others before, there are literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Australians at any time overseas. And there are still a very large number of Australians overseas. But in Peru, since we were able to support the Chimu flight and provide it with the government assurances to enable it to go ahead, we are continuing to work with Qantas on further flights to assist Australians who are still there. And also trying to facilitate internal travel for Australians who are in more remote and isolated parts of Peru to come to the city centres, to come to Lima, to Cusco, so that they are able to access those flights. I expect to have more information from my department, from Qantas, on those in the coming days.
Does the curfew mean that some Australians just might have to ride it out, or are you hopeful that you'll get everyone out?
The internal restrictions are going to mean it's very difficult for some people to move around, but we are working with local authorities to seek travel permissions and movement permissions, working with local agencies to facilitate transport to endeavour to do that. But there are some parts of Peru which are obviously very isolated, and we will do as much as we possibly can. But I have said, Prime Minister has said from the very beginning of this crisis, when we began to encourage Australians to reconsider their need to travel to return to Australia, it will not be possible to bring everybody home. And of course, not everybody wants to come home. Many are prepared to stay in places they've lived for a long time. But in very, very remote areas, it is certainly difficult.
There are two cruise ships heading now to Florida, the Zaandam and Rotterdam, with a substantial number of Australians on board. But the Florida authorities have said that they won't allow passengers with COVID-19 to be dumped there. How are you dealing with that?
Yes, the Zaandam and the Rotterdam are both very large vessels. There's been an extraordinary transfer of passengers at sea between those vessels, and some in some cases very much older passengers. We're working with officials there to seek support for them to be allowed to disembark and to take flights home. That includes local government officials and, of course, making representations direct to US authorities. We're making those representations both here in Australia and in the United States. We understand that the Centre for Disease Control will monitor the signs of illness, and they certainly will have a requirement about meeting certain levels of health status before people are allowed to travel. Again, the complexities of different countries' rules and requirements is something that we are managing on literally an hourly basis.
Is there a touch of irony here? Australia is wanting to get Australians off cruise ships in foreign waters, yet here in Australia, New South Wales police has given the Ruby Princess orders to move on, and so too the WA government wants ships out of Australian waters. Why should the government expect cooperation when state governments here are taking a tough line?
Well, this is a very difficult balancing process. We have to protect Australians. We have to protect and support Australians overseas as well and get them home in a way that is safe for them and safe for Australians here. In terms of the Ruby Princess, the Australian Border Force, working closely with the New South Wales government in relation to the crew on the Ruby Princess, but there has been a biosecurity determination imposed which said any vessel which departed from an international international port after mid-March is not permitted into an Australian port without express permission. I understand that some crew members from the Ruby Princess who are unwell have, of course, been transferred to health facilities in the past couple of days. There are a number of pregnant women on the Ruby Princess who have also been transferred. But this is a process which we are going through with the cruise ship companies, through the Australian Border Force, the Department of Home Affairs, to determine what is possible. The ship movements in Western Australia, again, a large number of unwell passengers who are currently receiving treatment in Western Australian hospitals, and then a much larger cohort again of passengers who were transferred on flights, Lufthansa flights, back to Germany. Every single case is different, Sabra, and we are handling them one at a time, but also very conscious of what we need to do to protect Australians.
Minister, thanks for your time.
Thanks very much, Sabra.
That's the Foreign Minister, Maurice Payne. In Italy, victims of COVID-19 have been honoured with a minute's silence, while Spain has recorded its largest death toll in a day. The UK has also recorded its largest number of deaths in 24 hours. Europe correspondent Samantha Hawley reports.
As in Spain the day before, Italy paused to remember the dead, now almost 12,500 of them, a rise of 837 in 24 hours.
In questo momento, tutta l'Italia si stringe.
In this moment, all of Italy pulls together, the mayor of Rome, Virginia Raggi, says. We must make it for them, so that their sacrifice will not be in vain. In Madrid, as rain fell, graves were dug, and loved ones buried. Spain recorded its worst day yet, with 849 deaths. The hospitals are at breaking point, with more than 5,500 patients in need of intensive care. In the UK too, the death toll is climbing. Cabinet Minister Michael Gove.
Yesterday we recorded the highest single increase in the number of deaths as a result of COVID-19.
That's 381 deaths in 24 hours, taking the total to 1,789.
Every death is the loss of a loved one, and our thoughts and prayers are with those who are grieving.
Across the UK, more than 10,700 people have been hospitalised with COVID-19, a third in London. But health officials say the infection rate is dropping since shutdown measures came into force. The medical director of the NHS is Stephen Powers.
It's early days. We're not out of the woods. We're very much in the woods. And it's really important that we keep complying with those instructions.
This is Samantha Hawley in London, reporting for AM.
Despite supermarkets being busier than ever, coronavirus restrictions are hitting Australian food producers hard. A massive drop in international flights has shut down important export markets, leaving some businesses out of pocket and trying to find new ways of selling their goods. But the federal government's now thrown farmers and exporters a lifeline. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
When countries like Hong Kong, Singapore and China went into lockdown, West Australian abalone exporter Brad Adams watched his sales plummet. Before the pandemic, his ASX-listed company, Ocean Grown Abalone, had a market value of $30 million. That's now halved. And even though demand from Asian markets is starting to pick up, he's got another problem.
As the COVID-19 restrictions have been reasonably successful, so people are now on the streets eating out as usual, so we're seeing that our customers are placing orders again from beginning of the year when there was a complete lack and drop-off of orders to now where there's actually some demand turning up in the market. So we thought, great, we'll send you some products. And then we started finding out that the options of getting air freight, which is how most seafood is transported, or particularly high-value products, there was no way of getting it out because with the complete shutdown of flights, most freight goes in the underbelly of planes. So there were some real issues there.
The massive reduction in international flights has left businesses unable to get products like seafood, red meat, fruit and vegetables to customers overseas. Now the federal government is seeking to solve two problems at once. Working with exporters and airlines, it will spend $110 million to help facilitate chartered cargo flights to get fresh Australian produce into key markets in Asia and the United Arab Emirates. When they return, those flights will have the capacity to transport vital supplies like medicine and medical equipment back to Australia. For Australian farmers reliant on export, the plan is a lifeline.
When you've got growers that have been relying 30% of their crop or 40% of their crop is grown for export and then you can't get a plane, becomes difficult.
Jenny Franceschi supplies fresh fruit and vegetables to customers overseas, mainly in Asia. In the past 4 weeks, her export business has ground to a halt. She doesn't expect much improvement in the months to come, but says the government freight assistance will help secure ongoing trade.
By keeping Australian exporters exporting and keeping our produce out there, what it will do is just secure the position for Australia in those countries, because if other countries move in, then we've got to try and win it back, and that's hard.
While it won't solve all of his problems, abalone exporter Brad Adams says it's a start.
It's fantastic because the market in Australia that we had for abalone has collapsed because there's no restaurants open, there's no Chinese tourists, so that important market is gone and it's probably going to be gone for a long time. But particularly overseas, obviously the demand isn't what it used to be, but at least there is some demand for our products, so at least we can get some out.
Minister for Trade Simon Birmingham has also announced additional funding for export marketing grants and a commitment to waive Commonwealth levies for fishers for the remainder of 2020.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting. Country doctors, mayors and a federal cabinet minister want state governments to close off rural shires, similar to how state borders have been shut in response to the coronavirus crisis. There are reports of people exiting capital cities for rural towns, and GPs are warning those communities are vulnerable because their hospitals wouldn't cope if many people became sick. Given that, in a pandemic, what are the rules? How are people allowed to, escape and hide in holiday homes and rentals? Here's National Rural Reporter Caitlin Gribben.
Trading the city for country air might sound like an appealing escape from coronavirus, but most political leaders are telling people to stay at home. Yet in Coonabarabran, nearly 6 hours northwest of Sydney, GP Anilo Yanuzzi says out-of-towners are moving in.
There are some people who may have country houses who are retreating to their country houses. We've had inquiries, people from the city looking for rental accommodation for a medium to long term so they can get out of the city. So there are definite cases of this happening.
And the doctor is worried about what could happen if city visitors bring coronavirus to town.
The reality is smaller rural hospitals are not designed or geared up for ventilated patients. And this is going to be the scary thing if COVID-19 pops up in these small towns.
Anyelo Yanuzzi, who's also the deputy mayor of the local council, wants drastic measures to force city people to stay away.
We are very vulnerable in these rural areas, and perhaps closing state borders is not enough for us, and we need to be looking at closing shire borders. You close a state border, it doesn't stop people from Sydney and Newcastle coming out to small towns that aren't equipped to deal with COVID. Whereas you close a shire border, you are actually protecting the community within that shire a lot better than by closing the state border.
All states and territories have asked people to avoid non-essential travel, but some have taken it further than others. WA has restricted travel between its regions, and those breaking the rules can be fined $50,000. Victoria and New South Wales are threatening fines too, although Victoria's Premier Daniel Andrews believes it's legally very difficult to stop people from going to their own holiday houses. Tasmania's Premier Peter Gutwin has been pretty blunt about his preference.
These are tough rules, I know that. It's a tough topic. And I want to make the point that for those that love their shacks, you won't be able to go to your shack for school holidays or for Easter.
Federal Cabinet Minister David Littleproud, whose electorate of Maranoa covers a huge area of Western Queensland, says city people are travelling to those regions by car and caravan. He says states must consider closing off rural areas.
I think that is a solution that needs to be explored, because if we continue to see people ignore the advice, then we're going to have to act more strongly. We are putting the lives of people in the outback at risk. And what these communities are starting to feel is the anxiety of COVID-19 and these caravans becoming the cruise ships of the outback.
Small beach towns hold similar concerns. Heather Wellington is a councillor in Victoria's Surf Coast Shire, which covers much of the Great Ocean Road.
It's not a time for holidays now. We need to be very patient. It's going to be really hard, but it's just critically important that people don't come down and flood the seaside towns.
That's Surf Coast Shire Councillor Heather Wellington ending Caitlin Gribbin's report. As the opposition leader noted on AM yesterday, the childcare sector now in serious strife because of the pandemic. Parents are being forced to weigh up job losses and health concerns as they decide whether to give up hard-won childcare places. Industry groups estimate attendance has dropped by at least 30%, and while the Prime Minister's declared daycare an essential sector, some providers have been forced to shut their doors. Political reporter Anna Henderson has more.
Hi, Mira. What's going on?
Miranda Edwards would normally be greeting toddlers and young children as they burst through the door at the Indigenous daycare centre she runs in the Victorian city of Shepparton. But it's almost completely empty, so she's calling them via video app to see how they are.
What are you doing?
I'm at home.
Oh, you're at home. Are you having fun?
Really lovely, like just to see their little faces and smile and, you know, just to see them and reach out to them, so it was really nice.
Lala's Children and Family Centre usually has about 25 kids attending, but today they only had one-year-old Kevin.
For me as the director, and I know the staff are feeling it too, that, you know, we're heartbroken that this is happening.
The coronavirus pandemic has hit Australia's daycare sector and its 200,000 staff hard. Usually 1.3 million Australian children would be in daycare, allowing their parents to work and contribute to the economy. To support them, the federal government pays a subsidy for each child that attends. Labor's early childhood spokeswoman Amanda Rishworth says if parents pull out, the results will be devastating.
Not only will those centres no longer be getting fees from parents, but they no longer will get the government subsidy as well. And as a result of that, we're seeing centres that have started closing their doors. And I've heard reports of centres closing their doors, and this is a permanent closure of these centres.
And she says that means crucial health workers will be forced to stay home.
I've had some calls even today where people have said to me, where can I send my children? Because the childcare centre has closed down.
Education Minister Dan Tehan was not available for interview, but the government has moved to support the industry. The number of days a child is absent before they lose their subsidy has been extended from 42 to 62 days. There is financial hardship assistance for parents, and centres can apply for a grant of between $10,000 and $50,000. Back at Lulla's Centre in Shepparton, Portia Atkinson has arrived to pick up one-year-old Kevin.
Oh, look, I'm so happy that Lulla's childcare centre is still open. It means the world to me.
Portia is an Indigenous liaison worker in the emergency department of a Shepparton hospital, where they are preparing for COVID-19 cases.
Yeah, it's just a relief to me knowing that he's cared for in a safe place. He's just safe. Yeah.
Indigenous health worker Portia Atkinson ending Anna Henderson's report, and childcare will be on the agenda this Friday at a scheduled National Cabinet meeting. Let's head back overseas now. The Indonesian government has been warned it could face more than 140,000 deaths and 1.5 million cases if it doesn't take urgent steps to stop the spread of the coronavirus. The figures are in a report to the government by medical experts at the University of Indonesia. The warning coincides with a huge funding package to cushion the economy. Indonesia correspondent Anne Barker reports.
In Sulawesi, a family mourns the death of a 34-year-old woman from acute pneumonia, almost certainly a victim of coronavirus. Hospital staff have wrapped her body in plastic, according to World Health Organization protocols to prevent contagion. But according to Islamic tradition, the family later removes the wrapping to prepare the woman's body for burial, seemingly oblivious to the risk. Indonesian health authorities have now issued strict new guidelines on burial procedures to minimise the chance of contagion as the spread of coronavirus accelerates. Officially, the number of positive cases in Indonesia is now more than 1,500, with 136 dead, most of them in Jakarta. But medical experts warn Indonesia faces a vastly higher death toll within a month if it fails to impose much tougher measures to curb the spread of the virus. It could cause 1.5 million people to be infected, and deaths would increase to 144,000 people, says Dr. Pandu Riono, a researcher at the University of Indonesia and co-author of a report to the government. He's one of several medical experts who warn that current measures, encouraging but not forcing people to stay at home, are barely enough to bring that death toll down. It needs a massive, structured effort to impose social distancing, he says, with mass testing of people and massive education and regulation to punish those who violate it. It has to be forced. With thousands of people now leaving Jakarta ahead of next month's annual Eid al-Fitri holiday, Dr. Riono says the timing is urgent to stop the virus spreading even more rapidly. They must decide this week, he says. They have to take high-intensity intervention. The report says swift action now could save more than 100,000 lives and reduce the death toll to as low as 12,000. But President Joko Widodo, despite declaring a public health emergency and banning foreigners into the country, refuses to lock down the capital and talks more about economic measures to protect the poor and vulnerable. He's now pledged the equivalent of $40 billion to bolster the economy, the financial system and public health. He's flagged measures to restrict the movement of people but is yet to reveal the detail or how far they'll go. This is Anne Barker reporting for AM.
We've been swamped with many sad and desperate reports about the pandemic, but there have also been amazing stories of random acts of kindness, and here's one from India. How a local helped a group of tourists, including an Australian, to safety amid fears they were carrying COVID-19. South Asia correspondent James Oshin reports.
Australian Stuart Dufty planned to stay in India for months, so when a national lockdown was announced, he thought he could ride it out. But things took a sudden turn for the worse. One hotel said they were closing. Another claims they weren't allowed foreigners. Things weren't looking good.
Even friends here are reluctant to take me in. Some of them is because they think I've got corona, which I've known them like 20 years. But to others, they don't want to rock the boat with their neighbours by bringing in a foreigner.
His friends had heard about a hostel not too far from the Delhi airport that was taking in foreign tourists. Suddenly, he had a refuge.
Oh, it's been amazing here.
The hostel was found by Indian national Shubham Dharamsakhtu. He was travelling the state of Rajasthan as lockdowns were being introduced across the country. A 26-year-old saw tourists frantically running around, unsure where to stay or what to do.
Suddenly, I saw a lot of local people coming to them and telling them, you know, screaming corona on their face. And the whole situation was getting out of the hands.
So he booked a train ticket to Delhi for himself and 8 tourists. Along the way, he picked up a few more. And once he reached the capital, Shubham phoned around until he found a foreigner-friendly hostel.
I felt bad as an Indian that this is happening in India where, you know, we love guests and we are famous for hospitality. So I decided I should do something.
Shubham could have stayed with family in Delhi, but instead he set up camp at the hostel and put his phone number on social media for stranded tourists to call.
One day, this whole thing got viral. And from that day, it's been almost like 10 days and I'm getting over 100 calls and almost like 500 messages every day.
Shubham even tries to help those outside Delhi get food and accommodation.
Because a lot of people are stuck here and I've been traveling a lot and I know the condition when you're stuck at some place when there's no language. You know, you can't talk in the local language and you're stuck.
But not every Australian is content. Jai Hultum is so desperate to leave the west coast state of Goa, he's booked a ticket on a flight the Finnish government organised for its citizens to get home.
It is a risk that I won't end up on that flight, and there is a possibility that I could lose money on the flight, but it's a risk I was willing to take.
Australians stranded in India are being urged to register their contact details with the High Commission. This is James Oden reporting in New Delhi for AM.
That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
There are a lot of guesses about how long it's going to take for life to get back to normal. But what if it's longer than anyone is saying? A lot longer.
Today, it's Australia's timeline for dealing with COVID-19 and the possibility that saving lives will take many more months than what we've been told.
Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.